Hello and welcome to the podcast. This week we have Nick with us as usual. And we're going to talk about a few stories that we saw over the weekend and on Monday. We're going to talk about why does Micheál Martin need 19 special advisors, especially compared to the number of special advisors in the UK. We're also going to talk about what big change would we make to Irish policy, an idea that was floated in the Irish Times. Surprisingly, unsurprisingly, after a lot of negative media publicity, the majority of Irish people want Twitter banned. And finally, we will celebrate Jess Buckley's nomination for Best Actress for the Oscars this year. So, first of all, Nick, how are you? How's your weekend?
Yeah, very good. Good to be back. I think last week's podcast went down very well. Great feedback. And yeah, happy to be back again this week.
Yes, yeah, the weather continues to be not very forgiving, I think, for it's not if it's not raining, it's windy. If it's not windy, it's raining. Or indeed today, it is both. But anyway, it is January, so I suppose that's to be expected. Nick, you saw a piece actually in the Irish Times today. Probably they do this every year. Who are the 19 special advisors to Micheál Martin and Simon Harris, and what do they do? So they give a list. This is all of exactly the top advisor to Micheál Martin is Idirdje Jalan, and she's on over 200,000 euro a year, although it does say part of that is gifted back to the state following state pay reduction measures. So Nick, do you want to I've got a good idea of what the special advisor role in British politics anyway. Do you want to explain to the viewer just what are who are these people and what do they do?
Yeah, I suppose, when the elected politicians or leaders get a lot of criticism, and I suppose they're only as good as their people that inform them. And these are extremely well-paid team of advisors that are handpicked by Micheál Martin or Simon Harris. And you mentioned Idirdje Jalan there, like, she's known as the real Taoiseach. Apparently, if anything gets done, it goes by her. If you want to get to Micheál Martin, you have to go through her. Apparently, she has, enormous amounts of power, and that's something that's well known. But what gets at people mostly is that the qualifications of these people. Most of these people are loyal party devotees or, journalists that have just written very good soft pieces about Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael over the number of years and get promoted to head of comms or media. And then, there's some new additions that I hadn't seen before. There's digital advisors, and these are two 20-year-olds that are basically tasked with managing the social media accounts of Micheál Martin and Simon Harris, and they're getting paid, 120 grand. Like, it's just an enormous amount of money. And I just don't think the right people are in these roles. I would like to see people with much better business track records, professional people, whether they're solicitors, doctors, or accountants or engineers. I think this is the part, these are the roles that should be filled with experts, because the experts, we know that the experts aren't, the Minister for Finance has never done a financial degree. The Minister for Defence, is Helen McEntee, who knows nothing about defence. So this is the opportunity to be able to appoint a high-class team of advisors, but they miss this opportunity and they just feather their nest with yes men around them, basically.
Well, I think there's a few points wrapped up in that. I mean, first of all, special advisors now the job is because if they get a lot so much media scrutiny, it's do we want a special advisor, as you say, an expert in relation to the area, the policy area that the government may be putting together, or is it what you might call just communications all the time? Press officers, they probably have separate communications team or comms for short, and is it just about always getting the best media coverage for the minister. I think it's probably, you know, if those roles are being conflated, it's a problem. I mean, in fairness to the chief of staff, she's been advisor to Micheál Martin for 25 years. So she's obviously going to be ultra loyal. And in fairness to her, she has a career as a nurse and worked as an official for the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. I quite like the sound of that, if I'm honest. I think I accept that, you know, expertise in business and defence is important. But she isn't somebody, the big criticism in the UK sometimes for special advisors or indeed ministers is that they've never had a real job. Well, I don't know how long her nursing career is. Sounds like that was a real job for me, you know, to me. She obviously sounds like she's the equivalent of, I think, Susie Wiles in the White House, who is the gatekeeper for President Trump. So I think there's the mixture of things. So lack of expertise in a particular area may well be a fair criticism. The other criticism, though, which I think we need to tease out and is separate from just whether or not they have expertise, is this issue of journalists, of a former journalist becoming what I call special advisors, SPADs for short, or the derogatory term bag carriers, because that is a borderline conflict of interest and it's a legitimate criticism that if you're a journalist, you know, in Irish media, you are supposed to be holding truth to power. You're supposed to be keeping these guys in line. And then if after an election, suddenly you are now on board as a special advisor or communications assistant or whatever they might be, well, how tough was your journalism beforehand? You know, and I think in Irish media, you know, obviously some papers lean left or lean right. And I think a lot of people have a problem with that, with a journalist who 5 minutes ago was criticizing, you know, perhaps Fine Gael relentlessly. And then suddenly they become a communications director, even say to the Labour Party. That I think is a problem.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what compounds all of this is that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been in power for just so long. So these people these are now jobs for life for some of these people. And there's no rotation, there's no moving on from it because it's such a comfy number. There's no, within politics, loyalty is rewarded because politics is hard. And if you're someone that is willing to go out and, you know, hold up a sign or go canvassing when you're not in power, you know, that takes dedication. Like, I've been out canvassing myself, and the people that come with you, you know, to do it, you're like, you must be crazy, because you're literally doing this out of sheer volunteerism. Whereas these people did that maybe 20 years ago and have just been rewarded ever since. So it would be interesting to see, you know, a rotation of this, of these people, because some of them have been there far too long. You just look at Simon Harris. He's been in government for, you know, over 15 years now, I think. And he's never been in opposition, and all his advisors are in the same boat. So I see this list comes out every year and it's the same names all the time, pretty much. And I'm just kind of sick of it. I want new ideas. I don't think there's any new advice or policies coming out of this. And, you know, something else we're touching on, you know, is Davos this week. The World Economic Forum, you know, if you mention the World Economic Forum in conversation, you were kind of labeled a conspiracy theorist because, oh, what's this person going to talk about now? And even though it's a real thing, it always has been. But this week in Davos, there was a noticeable shift in the conversations coming out of World Economic Forum. They weren't talking about climate change. They weren't talking, you know, they were talking about innovation, progress, and different things like that. And there has been a shift in attitude towards policy. And I'm wondering, is anybody on these lists getting the message?
Well, I mean, we can look at the big shift in Davos in relation to US foreign policy. And I mean, I don't think they're they would have missed the huge shift that's happening now in the United States in relation to foreign policy. But I mean, just the other, for people who were sort of very interested in political intrigue, what I noticed is, again, and we touched on this last week, is, you know, do you actually have to be from Cork to really go foreign politics? And how big is the conspiracy in relation to the Cork men and women? Because two things jumped out at me. First of all, as we mentioned last week, it's Claire Mungovan, who's a special advisor to Simon Harris, and she is first cousin to Keir Starmer's chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, who is very well known now in the British media and probably handling the fallout of the blocking of Andy Burnham running for MP in a by-election over there. I mean, he allegedly runs the show, and they are first cousins. So that's an extremely close link, both from Cork. But the other thing that also struck me, if you care about taxpayers' money, is also, and you know, some people might like this, is they are really paid quite a lot in Ireland. So the chief of staff here is paid €206,000, although with the proviso that some of that is going to be paid back, it's not clear what. And if you go to Morgan McSweeney, and this is a matter of public record because they publish who the their special advisors are on pay bans, and they publish it in the UK. So Morgan McSweeney is on, from last year, I think the maximum he would be on is £160,000, which probably, I'm not going to get out my conversion, maybe close, or perhaps Sweeney's on a little bit less. And I'm sorry, but I do think it's a little bit ridiculous that a country that's much smaller than the UK are probably paying their special advisors more. You know, the United Kingdom has a population of about 60 million. They're part of NATO. They've got nuclear weapons. They still have overseas territory, yet their special advisors are paid the same or indeed less than the special advisors over in Ireland. And again, if you compared, I think I draw an analogy to, you know, what the BBC presenters are paid and what the presenters in RT are paid. And like, I it's not that I think we should undervalue our people, but you know, all of this is taxpayers' money, and there's a lot less taxpayers' money in Ireland than there is in the UK because there's a lot fewer taxpayers. So I don't understand why the you know, the pay is basically more over there or the same.
Because they control the money. You know, Ireland has, we have more money, we are richer, we are more profitable than the UK because of our corporate tax intake. And we can afford to do this. You know, we can afford to jack up people, you know, government advisor salaries, TD salaries, and so on. And sorry, I'm actually for paying TDs more. What it should be, the way you pay TDs more is not like, okay, we're going to pay everyone more from next week. It's after the next election cycle, which is 4 years from now, we are going to up the salaries of TDs and ministers. And that creates an incentive going into an election cycle for better people to put their name, you know, forward. That's how you do it. You give everyone a fair shot at those, even though it's not totally fair, but that's the only way to do it. But at the moment, what they do is they vote to up their salaries every year on an incremental basis, and maybe the year of an election they won't do it because they don't want to.
I wouldn't mind paying them more if they actually got some results. You know, that it didn't take years and years to build. Well, we're still, you know, without a metro, or that the children's hospital wasn't constantly over budget, or they didn't spend all the money on, you know, a bike shed. I know what you mean. I'm not necessarily one for like slashing salaries of TDs or indeed their special advisors, but I mean, you know, you should be paid. If the results are consistently so poor, then you know, the motivation to pay them is a lot less. But just, you know, it's anyway, the special advisors, I just don't understand why they need so many, and I don't think they should be pay quite as much as they do. But anyway, speaking of taxpayers' money, the Irish Times ran a piece on Saturday, I think, and you picked it up and had some interesting thoughts on Twitter. And it was, I think they asked, you know, the great and the good, one big idea. So Voices from Irish Life choose a single thing the government should and could try to accomplish in its second year in office. So you noticed how Maria Steen, another presidential, somebody who sought a nomination anyway, spoke about tax individualization, which goes all the way back to 2000. Now, although, you know, tax can be complex and initially seem boring, it's incredibly important in terms of how families operate. So if you want to give us a quick summary now on just say the average family would be taxed in Ireland, and Maria, I agree with her on this, says essentially it means more women are sort of forced to work outside the home, especially when the children are smaller, and if you had a different tax system, the families would be able to have a choice over.
Yeah, well, one thing. So the article was, you know, it's actually an interesting piece by the, or feature by the Irish Times on the weekend edition. And it asked, you know, number of 20 or so people, what's one thing you would ask the government to do? If you could pick anything. And I suppose, you know, people leaned into their niche or you know, not it, the idea wasn't solve housing. It was something kind of unique. And the one I picked up on was Maria Steen's tax individualization. It's something I've talked about before, and it's something that goes to the heart of you know, society, family, what's the purpose of all of this? What's the purpose of paying taxes? What's the purpose of having Google here, you know, paying such high corporation tax? And the purpose should be family. It should be society. And what happened in the budget of 2000, and it was Charlie McCreevy's budget, was that they removed this concept where married couples were taxed as a whole. And so what the result was that it forced the stay-at-home parent, which is usually the mother, into work in order to reduce their tax burden. So the way it works is if you have a husband and wife, or a married couple, and they're both on 35 grand a year, they will pay a certain amount of tax. But if you have one of those couple on 70 grand a year, so same total, that couple will pay, I think, 6 or 7 grand more in tax because the other spouse isn't working. And the argument I use for all of this is that we went through a marriage equality referendum that gave, you know, same-sex couples the right to marry. And there was a huge, you know, they wanted to marry because marriage is seen as sacrosanct and, you know, the gold standard. And this reduces marriage. It's not got to do with kids, although it matters for families and children. But if you're a same-sex couple and a family member is ill and you need to stay at home and become a carer for them, then you're affected by this as well. So it's not just, yeah, it should affect everyone. And it comes to, you know, society and like married couples, whether it's same sex or not same sex or whatever, if you're married, that means something, and it should mean something for tax as well. So this came in and it was a labor force thing. And there's a brilliant, brilliant clip of Michael Noonan arguing this with Charlie McCreevy on Primetime or whatever program back in 2000. And it's up on my X feed. Yeah. I repost it all the time. And Michael Noonan is actually the hero in this conversation. I know people have other views on him, but he said all this and predicted it. And I thought it was brilliant that Maria Steen raised it as her one thing she would do.
Yeah, so the previous to that change, I mean, it was a change that I think also was pushed by the feminists. What taxes our families were taxed as a unit, and then after that, it was the husband was taxed separately and the wife was taxed separately. So I think the nitty gritty means that your tax free allowance is shrunk if you're taxed on an individualized basis, and you end up paying more tax. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I think isn't it the case here though that you can still share a tax allowance? So, if your wife doesn't work, for instance, you can claim a certain amount of her tax-free allowance. That's what I think does soften the blow. I mean, normally I'm always arguing what you're arguing, Nick, but just to be thorough, which I think does soften things somewhat. And I think the other issue here in Ireland, at least, is that you still get child benefit is still universal, whereas in the UK, it goes once you the cliff edge on incomes in the UK is incredible. You lose all of your child benefit after earning, I think, 60 grand. Whereas there's still child benefit here. And I think you can still pool a tax allowance. So I think that does soften the tax individual, you know, the blow in terms of taxing people individually. I mean, would it not just be easier to say cut income tax and cut VAT, for instance?
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, completely. That's all I talk about. And, you know, USC, you know, cut USC.
Yeah.
And especially for low income workers, like all these tax benefits, you know, we pay so much into the system that you have to be looking to get money back. And you mentioned some schemes there, you know, you can share credits and things like that. But most people don't have time or the wherewithal to actually go and do that. And the easiest way to actually help people is just stop taxing them in the first place. And we're taking so much of USC, it's up to 6 or 7%. You enter the high threshold for tax in Ireland at €44,000. And minimum wage now is almost, you know, if you work 9 hours a day, 5 days a week, it's minimum wage is around €31,000-€32,000. So it's only a 10 grand gap between minimum wage and the high. My rate, that's crazy. And I've said this before, and, you know, but we need someone to actually overhaul our tax system. And because the incentive to work, the incentive to create business and all that is just falling by the wayside. And like, I see it.
Yeah. Well, there isn't enough lobby groups either. I mean, this is the other point. Taxpayers alliance, I think, in the UK. We could probably do with an Irish version, but then that is just known as the voter. But the problem is that, you know, people who are concerned about this, they don't have time to organise. But I think the what I did find interesting, although perhaps predictable in relation to that Irish Times piece, is that so many of the, you know, and it is easy to criticise, but so many of the ideas were essentially just, could you please give some free money to this particular group of people? So there was Joseph O'Connor, he was a novelist and professor of creative writing. He wants every Irish teenager to be given a £300 culture voucher, redeemable in bookshops, cinemas, theatres and concerts halls. So we seem to be paying teenagers to go and see, I don't know, a horror movie, will that be restricted, or a Marvel movie? I'm not sure that's a great use of taxpayers' money. Justine McCarthy, of course, wants some big, massive constitutional referendum just to strip out all the gendered language, and I suspect most of the religious language. At least that wouldn't cost us much money. Another film producer wanted to do something to do with housing. Compulsory purchase legislation. Fair enough, that won't cost us too much.
That's not too bad. Yeah, that was one of the better ones.
A national development plan wanted a world-class sporting facilities. Don't have a huge problem with that either, although that's not going to be cheap. Fintan of Tool, of course, wants more free money. This is a second child benefit payment going to the poorest children. To lift 55,000 people out of poverty. Go on.
So you can't argue with you know the reason or the intended outcome of Fintan O'Toole's suggestion, right? Which is more money for children on poverty. But Fintan O'Toole and the Irish Times never actually look or want to look at the abuse of these systems. Ever. And like, how can we cut them or how the fact that giving more and more money away actually isn't solving the problem. Like, we are spending more money now on homelessness than we've ever had. But the homeless crisis is just getting worse. We're feeding the problem. And I don't know if you saw the court case during the week. of the man, the Romanian man who came here in 2000 and something, and he's been here for 20 something years, never had a job, and he was claiming that he got run over by a car and he was in a wheelchair. Did you see this guy?
No, I didn't.
It was absolutely hilarious. So he was claiming an insurance claim. It was on, in fairness, it was on RT News. They put it everywhere on the 9 o'clock news. But he was claiming that he was left in a wheelchair and the insurance company weren't buying it because he had a track record of this. And so they hired a private investigator to go and follow him. So the first video clip, you know, it's a secret recording. He's in his wheelchair and he's going into court. And then later that day, he's seen loading his wheelchair up into the boot of the car, because he's been sitting in the wheelchair, he does a few runs up and down the street and stretch out his legs. And it's absolutely hilarious. So my point is, it's so easy to con the system. This guy got caught, but he'd been doing it for 20 something years.
That is scary. Yeah.
And he's never worked. And you know, so Fintan O'Toole, the cost of his suggestion was 500 million for more children in poverty. And yeah, that's a great, how can you argue against that? But in reality, all this money is not ending up where it should be, or it's not having the intended effect.
Yeah. No, well, as I said, I was, it is always easy to ask for other people's money. You know, your intentions may well be good, yeah, but it is just true. And the question is, who is going to pay for it? And as I said, nowhere in that list was actually, can we reduce income tax? Maybe we should reduce VAT, one of the highest rates in the world. I also would have banned smartphones from schools and tax Amazon deliveries, but that's just the phase I'm in right now. I did notice an Abdallah Al-Jazar, who was a student from Gaza. Nick, I don't know if you read this bit, go down it, and he also thinks housing and health here in Ireland are terrible. Housing, my friends here complain, is too scarce and expensive. Health and housing don't exist in Gaza, and I had come here expecting paradise, but the complaints I hear sound so much like home.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Even so, he's now complaining. It just goes to show how your expectations, in fairness, this is a human instinct. Your expectations can adjust very, very quickly, because his home in Gaza was a tent, and now it's student apartments. But he has quickly, we must salute Abdallah. He's picked up the Irish, talent for complaining about better health and affordable housing. So that is what this student would from Gaza would like, which is perhaps a tad ungrateful. But anyway, he's integrated. Say that.
Yeah, there was the best. The other, very practical solution or idea was by Muireann Lynch, and she's an energy economist with ESRI, and she wanted to build 2,000 megawatts of new gas generation, which would be, $3 billion of capital spending, but completely needed. I wish politicians would speak this way. Peter Burke was at Davos during the week, and he went viral for a clip talking about diversity. But if you actually listen to the full interview, he was on a panel with the CEO of a major energy company. And the clip that went viral talked about how he said that we've got such a diverse workforce. But when you listen to the full interview, it was interesting to hear him talk about energy and energy targets and the amount of terawatts and that Ireland needs. But what was sad was that everything he said was a derivative of Europe. It's like, well, what Europe is going to do and we will implement. There was no proactive Ireland is doing this because we have our own autonomy. It was very much we are beholden to Europe's energy policy, which I think,
well, that I think is true legally.
We need to stop getting in our own way in terms of energy. And these climate targets, and you'll read about them in the paper every now and again, of this impending 10 or 20 billion euro fine in 2030 or whenever it matures. That's all rubbish. Someone needs to stand up and say, we're not paying that. That's a load of bullshit. Net zero is a joke. And the when I said earlier about the mood shifting, like Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, is no longer talking about DEI or ESG investing, which they championed. Okay.
Yeah.
And the whole
now most people will know DEI. Just ESG is the environment.
I think it's sustainability and governance, but basically, yeah. it's woke investing, and BlackRock championed it all over the last 10 years across Europe, and there's now regulatory frameworks around it, and you know, pension funds weren't able to invest in oil companies or defense companies because they weren't ESG compliant, and now Europe is getting the message and saying this is a load of bullshit. We need to invest in our energy companies. So they've changed the rules that in defense companies can now be ESG compliant. They're basically saying ESG compliant is nonsense. And Larry Fink said that at the end of Davos. He said, we need energy. You know, the world needs energy. There's a shift. It's all got to do with AI. We need these rare earth minerals. And that is completely different thinking to what has been going on. So Ireland has an opportunity to realize that they can just go and we can just go and do this stuff. We can build out
capacity. But I mean, Nick, I look, Ireland's part of the European Union, and they are limited, right, by all the very, don't shoot the messenger. Like, I mean, I wasn't born when they joined. If you want to extricate yourself from all of that, then, you know, the idea that they're not going to be fined, I don't see how Ireland won't be fined if they don't reach their carbon targets. I mean, I'm not necessarily for the carbon targets. A lot of people are dumping their net zero rules, but you know, they I would suspect if there's a fine to be paid, it will have to be paid.
No, but yeah, the targets were too ambitious to start with. We're not saying that, you know, we need to just, you know, burn oil all day long. You know, solar, definitely we should be doubling down on solar. Maybe wind, we're probably overconfident on wind, but definitely natural gas. We need as much natural gas as we can get. The interconnectors with France, you know, it's going to come online in 2028. That's great, but an interconnector, you're still dependent on French nuclear energy. Where's our policy to embrace small module reactors? And we don't have one. You know, nuclear energy is still illegal under the 1998 Act. All the government needs to do is just repeal that section, I think it's section 18 or something. And so it's one line, just repeal that and then just let market forces happen. Denmark are doing it. The UK has nuclear. France has nuclear. That it's not against European regulation to do that. So you know, there's so much we can do here. Energy, like the world is shifting to energy and rare earth metals. As we speak right now, just look at the price of silver and gold and palladium and copper. They are skyrocketing. People will say it's because of, you know, different effects, you know, because of monetary policies and things like that. But it's got to do with the race for rare earth metals.
Yeah, I wish I'd bought gold a while ago. Not that I have any money to do that. Listen, the other big shift in foreign policy, I mean, in terms of nuclear policy, I certainly think nuclear is the way to go because it doesn't have the carbon footprint. But we unfortunately don't have the expertise that exists either in France or the UK that have been running plants for decades. But I guess you do, you know, have to start somewhere. The other huge shift, obviously, in Davos, what is in American foreign policy. And, you know, it's been, it wasn't a surprise. This is the show Trump has been running for at least 2 or 3 years. America first, you know, now definitely seems to be America only. And although he rode back, obviously, on having, I think I heard the phrase enhanced relationship on the radio at one point over Greenland, he has essentially told the Europeans that, you know, they cannot assume that America will always be there to guarantee their security. But the truth is, you know, no matter how much the Europeans want to stand up to Trump, European security, which obviously includes Irish security, totally depends on the United States. And there was also an insult in relation to NATO troops including British troops. So the cartoon in the Sunday Times yesterday, the UK version, was of President Trump urinating on British war graves, which was, which, you know, it's only a political cartoon, but really sums up the mood there right now. I mean, I think Europe is in a pretty bad position right now because they keep saying they'll increase spending in defence. But the truth is, this is very difficult to do, especially when their welfare states are still so big.
Yes, Europe needs to get the memo, okay? The United States has got, like, so go back to COVID. During when the world shut down because of COVID.
Don't want to. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
When the world shut down over COVID, there was an immediate realization of how dependent America is on Chinese manufacturing. Okay. And supply lines all shut down. And finally, this policy of made in China came home to roost. And since then, Trump has leaned into this because he was talking about it before COVID, that we need to be America. They need to be America first. And focus on American manufacturing. At the moment, we talk about energy. Let's talk about solar. Solar panels cannot be made in America. You need the polysilicone from China to, or you did up until recently, from China in order to make the actual modules. And the same with rare earth. So America is completely dependent on China. And there's been a complete change in policy now. And because of the Big Beautiful Bill or the Inflation Reduction Act, there's all sorts of terms in these that give tax breaks for companies that have all of their supply chain based in America. Okay. And you see this with defense companies like Anduril, which will go public soon. Palmer Luckey's very high profile. There's newer solar companies, T1 Energy, things like that, that are all based in America, and that's their supply line. Europe has nothing like that, and we have no force. The European Union is, you know, a bunch of member states that it's not a federal, like, it's not a universal federal union that will have a nationalist force to make sure that it is fully independent of China and Russia. And so what's going to happen now is that America, by doing this, is going to push Europe into the arms of China. We're going to get more Chinese cars, more Chinese energy, more Chinese minerals or whatever. That's the risk. That's what people are talking about. And if you look at what Macron said when he stood up with the glasses at Davos,
yeah,
that's what he said. He said, we should be doing more business with China. And that's okay. That's fine. It'll be cheap. But we are then fully reliant on them. Europe needs to get the message. And some parts of Europe are seeing this. So there's the famous Draghi report that came out 2 years ago talking about how Europe needs to lean into innovation. And it depends on how quickly Europe will act on that report to see if we can have a movement of Europe first. I don't think it's going to happen. I think we'll always be dependent on the US, you know, for NATO, for different things. But the real question will be, how influential will China, Canada, and Russia become, you know, against Europe? Like Mark Carney's speech at Davos last week was very, very illuminating as well.
Yeah, well, look, I think, yeah, I still think the reality is that Europe is, you know, is very weak. And I don't take any joy in saying that, but they've been saying they're going to increase defense spending but some spending has occurred, but it hasn't gone on full. And when people say, well, we're going to increase, you know, 5%, we're going to increase it to 5%, say, of GDP. The other thing you have to consider is how much of that is going to be spent on pensions, because that's, you know, sometimes they say, well, we're going to increase defense spending, but it's all going to go, but not all, but some of it goes to military pensions. So the point is that, you know, when opposition leaders or parties say, well, you should stand up for Trump, we have to do this again, this is outrageous. And part of what he's been doing, you know, has been outrageous. The truth is, there's no point at the moment. Europe is not in a position to go it alone and defend. They cannot defend themselves. They're not in it. You know, Zelensky went there and rightly pointed out, I mean, yeah, Mark Carney may well have said, well, we can be, I think, a lower tier power. But the point is, as Zelensky says, you know, Europe is all talk and no action. And I mean, there are some really big structural problems that Trump indeed has pointed out, no matter how much people don't like. They have sustained huge levels of immigration. Integration is a problem. And, you know, the fertility rates are still going south. So, you know, I don't like to go on a doom loop, but I think things are... I think things are very difficult right now for Europe. I think one of the leaders in the Times is that the new world order cannot be wished away by a change in US president. You know, if it's Marco Rubio or JD Vance that follows, the position is going to stay the same. It's still going to be more America first, even if it was a Democrat. It's unlikely to change very much. So what you were seeing is an unraveling of the post-war consensus, you know, the liberal order, whatever way you want to say it. And the US sees China, I think, as the big threat. So if Europe, as you seem to think, is going to go or look to be trading more with China, that could cause a real problem. You know, Europe has been freeloading off the American taxpayer for decades, and it might be, you know, infuriating, but that's the truth. You know, I mean, Europe enjoys massive welfare spending, tiny compared to what the Americans have, and the Americans have said, you know, enough. We're not having it anymore. Obviously, Ireland is neutral, and we rely entirely on both the Americans, and they don't want to admit it, but it is true, the British armed forces for our security entirely.
Did you see one of Trump's sons was down in Dunbeg over the week? He made some comments, but he also said that Trump was coming to the Irish Open next summer, or this summer coming. That'll be just amazing. So over the next couple of weeks, we're going to see Micheál Martin go over to the White House. What's he going to say? What's he going to do? You know, typical Micheál Martin, he's going to play it safe, try and just be the ultimate diplomat and get through it. But will the MAGA administration allow him to just keep the head down and get through it? When you remember last year, they had Conor McGregor there on St. Patrick's Day. So how can they go from Conor McGregor back to normal? So surely there's a play here. And then Trump is obviously planning an Irish visit later this year. So it's just a very funny time for Ireland. Trump, all of the threats Trump made when he took office have come through, you know, Greenland, Gulf of Mexico, Venezuela, Gaza. The one thing that they said was all the tariffs, but they did say that they wanted to come after Ireland's tax loopholes.
Yeah.
And they haven't done that yet fully. They, you know, they've threatened tariffs on pharmaceuticals, and they've given pharmaceutical companies the opportunity to build factories in the US. But it hasn't hit properly. I wonder if there's a bigger Irish surprise to come.
Yeah, well, look, he certainly experienced Micheál Martin, and I think he did pretty well last year, in fairness, in just getting in, getting out of that White House. Obviously, the Zelensky thing had blown up just a few weeks beforehand. I mean, the 19 advisors, to the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach, I'm sure they'll have a bit of advice for them. Hopefully, he can keep the side going there. The other issue, I think we saw... within the Irish Business Post, although I can't see it right now, is that a majority, perhaps unsurprisingly after all the bad publicity, the majority of Irish people want Twitter banned. So are you giving up your Twitter? You're quite active there.
Yeah, I love X. I'm addicted to X. I use X for lots of things, not just politics, but actually investing, finding out what's going on in the world. AI. If you don't know what Claude Bot is this Monday morning, you're already so far behind, you know, the bleeding.
I definitely don't know what Claude, oh God.
It's the AI is just developing so fast. And at the moment, Claude Bot is basically the best way to describe it is Siri on steroids. It can just do anything for you. You need to install it. I haven't installed it yet. I plan to this week. It'll take a little bit of technical knowledge, which I don't have, but I'm willing to learn it to do this. But my point is X. X is where the world is happening. Okay, it is where all the smartest people are. It's where they're telling us, what they're researching, the best articles, the global leaders. That's where X is. But the story this week around X, and wasn't just that Business Post one, but it was Michael O'Leary taking on Elon Musk, right?
Yeah.
And that was fascinating. I get it. You know, like two titans. Michael O'Leary's a complete hero. He's a brilliant CEO, incredibly smart. But Michael O'Leary admitted that he's not on social media and he doesn't do social media, even though his company does. And he said, he said Elon Musk is an idiot because he helped Trump. So he clearly has Trump derangement syndrome. And now, as a carryover, he has Elon derangement syndrome. And I would say even Michael O'Leary would have no problem banning X because he doesn't really know what it is, even though his company is, has one of the best X accounts going. They're, Ryanair are hilarious on there. But he also said that not many of his passengers would pay for Wi-Fi on the plane. And I was like, I'd pay a tenner a flight if I could have Wi-Fi.
Can you not survive a flight without Wi-Fi, Nick? Now, you see, this is I've gone the other way now. My deeply conservative values, I'm going back to like the 90s, the best decade of all. I don't understand. Why can't, if you're flying to London, say, I don't know if you're what kind of flight you have in mind. Say you're flying to, why can't you last for an hour without internet? Look, read a book.
When I get on a flight, if anyone ever sees me in the airport about to get on a flight, what I'm doing is I'm downloading YouTube videos relentlessly onto my phone so I can watch them and listen to them for the flight. That's what I'm doing.
Well, let's counter this a bit. I mean, in terms of banning X, okay, if I'm honest, if I was to be contrary and the deep, deep conservative in me, I think a lot of people's lives, in fact, pretty much all of our lives would be better if X didn't exist, if I'm honest. Now, first of all, I will say this poll, which I think said, in fairness, John wrote about it yesterday for Gripped, I think it had... the platform is so widely hated that more than 6 in 10 Irish people favour an outright ban on it. Okay, I reckon all those six are actually on Twitter. But anyway, and this will, this has been, I accept that it's a media, it's certainly been a liberal media agenda to demonise X because they have lost control of the narrative. They are no longer the gatekeepers. There is certainly an impulse to censor views that they don't like there. Etc. Okay, but there is also a lot of other research, Nick, and this is genuine. I've done this millions of times, and I'm probably boring people. When I go into restaurants or I go into coffee shops and I see everybody on their mobile phone, it actually drives me completely demented. When I see them hand the kids mobile phones or iPads, it also drives me demented. And a lot of the research out now is, IQ rates are going down in the West. People say, oh, this is progress, this is development. Well, I also think that a lot, it's making people genuinely like stupid. It wrecks your attention span. I think it genuinely stresses you out. I also think there's just something, I mean, I'm a journalist, so okay, I've ended up watching it, but I've probably seen a video of at least 5 people die, right? Die before my eyes, not literally, because of Twitter. Okay, there was a Ukrainian girl. There was the man shot yesterday by ICE. There was the woman shot by ICE. And I saw a 10-year-old child being severely beaten by their mother. And this stuff is on Twitter. There's loads of other stuff on Twitter as well. And your brain is taking in so much information on that feed, right? Even if you're just on it for 10 or 15 minutes. And I think the algorithm has really changed, by the way. I don't know if you've noticed that. They push stuff in from people you don't follow. I'm like, why is this person in my Twitter feed? My time is definitely reduced on it. But like, I'm not going to ban it because it's a state power. Do I think people should reduce their time on Twitter? Do I think the world would be better if it didn't exist? If I'm really honest, yeah, I think the world would be better if Twitter didn't exist.
But I also think there's a
complete... I also think you should read a book on the plane, Nick. A hard, a paperback.
Yeah,
one that you can speak through.
I used to read books. Now I listen to podcasts. That's, you know, I listen to so many podcasts. But they also, it goes back to this Sinead Gibney comment the other week of, you know, we should nationalize the tech firms. And people just don't understand what these tech firms are. I can create, especially with AI now, I can create a Twitter clone in a matter of hours. Someone better than me could do it in a matter of minutes these days. It's just code. It's just a platform where you know, there's a feed. And what gives X its power is obviously its network, and it's got, you know, billions behind it in compute and storage and to keep it up and running. But there's nothing stopping me from creating a smaller social network, which me and all my friends or half of Dublin could jump on. You can't ban this. You can't ban lines of code. You can try and ban access to it by you know, having age verification. But even with everything that's going on, you're not going to be successful. So look, this is the way of the world. Unfortunately, it's up to each individual to decide whether they want to use it or not. But if you're Michael O'Leary and you admit that you're not on social media, then just take that, take what you've said as gospel and say that you don't understand what social media is either.
Look, I think, no, honestly, Nick, I have also listened to a podcast or two in my time, and social media also kills your productivity output. And I think the reason, now, Michael O'Leary is in a good position because he has minions, as you say, to run his social media accounts, okay? But the reason I suspect he's still so successful is actually he hasn't let social media, like, melt his brain. So, you know, this always sounds a bit smoke, but for on Saturday, my daughter was at her dance class as usual, so I've got 2 hours, and I went for lunch on my own in Drogheda, and I had bought the English Times, the paper version. So I brought that with me, and I turned off my smartphone, which is really old anyway, and I just had my Nokia so my husband could get in touch with me. And like, it's a totally different experience. It was a really enjoyable experience. I definitely think I took a lot more in reading the pieces than if I had read them, say, on a desktop or a smartphone. And then I know I think 10 or 15 years younger than me. And then I have to get this in here. I texted my husband on this Nokia with the predictive text, and I felt like I was like 20 again. It was amazing, and it also cuts down your time, because like it takes so long just to get out one word. It's just like yes or no, and you're reading a lot more. I do, you know, there's a lot of other, as I said, there's a lot of material out there on the damage social media does. I do think it wrecks your attention span. I do think it causes stress, and I think it wrecks your productivity rate. And I think if you went through all the top CEOs of the companies that have given us this brain frying, you know, tech, I reckon a lot of them do not go on social media as much as you think. But the other person, while we... I mean, I'm not going to ban Twitter, and I understand why, where the desire to ban it is coming from in some quarters. But one person, and we were talking about this beforehand, who definitely was not on Twitter because it didn't exist at the time, and indeed did not have a TV growing up, was Jeff Buckley, who was a Golden Globes winner for Hamnet, and has been nominated now for an Oscar nomination. I think she's got to be the favourite. And there was a really interesting article on her in the, I think it's the Irish version of the Sunday Times. And she, as I said, where did she come from? Killarney. And she grew up, she was the eldest daughter of five and didn't grow up. There was no TV in the house until I think she was 15. And I think this is really interesting, because I'm wondering, where is our creative output going to come from now if everybody is on their phones the whole time?
Yeah, well, look, I think you can still be creative if you're on the phone. But just talking about her, I haven't seen the film yet. I'm looking forward to seeing it. But yeah, I read that piece. She, you know, she had a very traditional upbringing. She played the harp. She didn't have TV, as you say. And, you know, the first thing I thought about when I read that piece was, oh my God, she's from Family B. you know, this traditional Irish family. They're based in Killarney. They own a hotel. I actually looked up the hotel. It's not, as far as I can see, used for any sort of accommodation services. So fair play to them. I'm sure they could have gone down that route and made a fortune. But I would say that I would love to have a chat with her dad as a hotel owner in Killarney and talk about tourism. There's a friend of our, all of ours, Paul Trevaux. I'd say they might know each other, might share some criticisms of government policy. But she is seems to be very traditionally Irish. She's went to London, I think.
This was to take place in one of the talent competitions, like with Andrew Lloyd Webber or something. Yeah, if you want to go into the arts, you eventually have to go to London.
Yeah, exactly. And so she went to London and I think someone supported her. There was a story of this man that supported her and just saw the talent in her. And yeah, she's made it. And you're right. You know, you can talent can come from all sorts of places and with all sorts of influences. And yeah, she wasn't distracted. You can say that. She focused on what she wanted to do. And yeah, I think she looks to be the next big Irish star.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Hamlet myself. I know the storyline. I assume most of the viewers are. I did research it a little bit extra. I won't give any spoilers, but I think most people know what it's about. It does involve the death of their, it's based on William Shakespeare, his wife, and the death of their child at about when he's 10 or 11. And I'm like, okay, I definitely don't need to see that movie. I know Steven Spielberg's involved, who is the king of emotional manipulation. And I have four children. I know how devastating it would be to lose a child. So I'm not going to, if I feel like crying for 45 minutes as a sort of form of stress relief, then I will go and see Hamlet. But I do remember seeing when I hadn't been that aware of Jess Buckley, and then I saw the photograph of her and I thought, oh, she looks really familiar. And I remember her from, she plays the sister of one of the princes in the BBC version of War and Peace. And if anybody, I watched that twice. I think it was on Prime at one point, and she is just absolutely exceptional in that series. She's a lesser well-known of the cast members because it is a who's who of the great British actors. Lily James is a lead and opposite James Norton. But she plays quite a tragic figure as well. She is the brother to one of the princes, and she is... she's just exceptional in it. She's so, so good in it. So I'm sure she is just amazing in Hamlet. I may watch it if it comes to the small screen. But yeah, I'm always interested in people's backstories in terms of, you know, what gives her her talent. And as I said in the paper, it said the young girl's childhood revolved around family sing-alongs, music lessons, hiking and swimming. And she actually played the Irish harp, clarinet and piano to a very high standard. She spent traveling from Killarney to Dublin for harp lessons. That is quite a journey. And she had no television allowed them to experiment creatively and spend time in nature as a family. And I also think it was interesting that she, I think, is the eldest daughter to, I think, five. She is the eldest of five. Yeah. So not wanting to sort of typecast or to stereotype, I just think her, you know, if you, I don't know much about acting, but as an actress, you know, you have to have lots of different life experiences, or at least read about them in a book, and you're drawing on your emotional reserves. I think being the eldest daughter of five children that's a sacred thing. And I suspect that she helped out with her brothers and sisters, you know, quite a lot. As well as having what seems like, as you said, a very Irish upbringing. And when you refer to that family B, that was that caused some controversy because it's in one of the sort of secondary school social development books, and sort of traditional Irish family was seen as a bad thing, whereas uber liberal metropolitan family was a big thing. But now we're celebrating, you know, the eldest daughter from quite a traditional Irish family. And I, some people would think, oh, it wouldn't make any difference. I definitely think not having a television has added to her talent. You know, just think of the amount of extra time she would have to either, you know, be creative, read a book, obviously play her instruments, or indeed, I suspect, put to work helping with small jobs around the house and helping her brothers and sisters. You know, I think that's a very different life to what young people, what children are doing today. You know, some of them spend inordinate amounts of time either watching television or indeed now on Instagram or Snapchat. And I really do think it kills their creativity. Others may disagree, but I don't think it's any accident that she had that her talent has come through with the background that she's had.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, I agree. She's focused on her the arts and her. You know, it's the same as if talking about Rory McIlroy. I doubt he was watching too much TV. I'd say he was out playing a lot of golf.
Yeah.
And same with anyone with a talent or a drive. I completely agree. But at the same time, you know, I don't want to be defending smartphones the whole time because I know how addictive they are. But if something I try to challenge people is that if you're going to be on social media, you should be contributing. And that's why I was on it so much. And I was like, okay, I'm on this thing. So I may as well make a few videos or write a long article and post it up. And now you're contributing. And now it's part, you know, you can make a career out of it. You can sell things online. You can build things online. So, you know, I think there's more education needed around smartphones. It's like, okay, are you a consumer or are you a contributor? Or are you a mix of both? And you don't have to put your name towards anything. You can create a profile on fancy cars or fancy houses and just post and comment about them. And there's a niche for everything. So it really depends how people use this. And, you know, with AI now, you can literally build a website without any code and just tell the prompt what you want. I want a nice blue website that looks like Airbnb, but instead of Airbnbs, we're going to rent out beds or something. I don't know. Or that's what Airbnb is, couches. And you can do all this. Like there is just such opportunity online. But again, I don't think people, in order to find that opportunity, you have to go online to find it. And I think mainstream does such a bad job of focusing of even talking about what's trending online. Like the thing I said earlier, Claudebot, there's nobody in Ireland that's actually talking about this. It's all happening in America or China. It's all happening on X. You get tutorials on YouTube or wherever else. Scrolling mindlessly on TikTok, you know, that's not good. I'm not saying that's good. So there is a balance.
Yeah, that's why I like you, Nick. You stop the doom loop. You stop me sliding into abject depression over everything. That's why we need you here. Anyway, I know you said that you hadn't seen Hamlet. It is supposed to be some sort of emotional roller coaster where everybody in the cinema is left crying. I did say over the weekend, what are you a crier at movies? What was the last movie you cried at?
You mentioned Missing Children. There's a, I'm not sure if I fully cried, but I was very close to it. The film called Lion, which is about an Indian boy getting lost. And it's a brilliant film, but there's a few moments in it. Yeah. Watched that a good few years ago. I actually haven't been to the cinema in a long time. And I love this.
You've got a small child. Yeah.
And I love the cinemas, but we watch a lot of movies at home. You're currently watching Landman. It's a good series. Highly recommend it. You will not be crying during that, maybe with laughter. That's entertaining. So yeah, I'm due a trip back to the cinema.
Yeah, well, I think again, cinema is it is one of those. It's a good example, though, where ultimately it is nice to have a sort of a communal experience, because clearly it's great to be able to watch all this stuff at home, but there is something unique to think about, going to the cinema and you're out of the house and no one's going to crash through your door demanding a toy or whatever might go on, and I actually it is I have it, I can't remember the last time I went to the cinema. Might have been to see The Darkest Hour or something, which
That's a long
sounds,
time ago, yeah.
I'm not even too sure I've been in cinema in Ireland. That's a bit scary. Anyway, that was a good movie, but yeah, we're the same. Although I have a very bad habit of just watching very old movies. Well, when I say old sort of movies, when you grow up, that's what happens when you get to my age. It's all nostalgia. But listen, it was look, very best of luck to Jessie Buckley. I hope I'm pronouncing her first name correctly. She it there is a lot to be proud of. She's a great advertisement for Ireland and the more traditional way of life. So we will see what the Oscars bring for her. And we thank you again, Nick, for your time. And we will hopefully see you next week.
Perfect.